Welcome to Hail Varsity Radio, the voice of Husker Nation. Insight, opinion, expertise, with the biggest and best names talking Nebraska across the state. Join the show on Twitter at Hail Varsity and at Schmitz underscore radio. Call in at 402-466-ESPN or 1-800-825-5865. Here's Chris Schmitz and TJ Henning.
Welcome in. TJ Henning here in today, going solo. Chris Schmidt in Minnesota, finishing up that Minnesota Twins Yankees series with his family. Got a loaded show for you, though. Got Mike Babcock coming up next at 425, hailvarsity.com. Then we got Mike Shuhart, Wilderness Ridge Golf. We're going to touch on the British Open. To begin hour two, you got to be able to hear these interviews. Mike Gilbert, OJ's former agent, he's going to be with us. He's also going to be with us on Friday. So if you've never heard these interviews, you got to check them out. Jock Doc on Chris Jones' injury. And to begin things off here, I caught up with Addy Joseph. He writes for USA Today and For the Win on NBA basketball. Here is that interview for you. So crazy free agency period. Not winners or losers. I want two winners. So two teams you thought had a really good offseason, in your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Oklahoma City Thunder had the best offseason. They're the only team that moved from major problems to, oh man, this team has got a lot going for it. And that's a huge step because they had some real roster problems last season that they basically solved with just two additions that will dramatically change the way they play in Paul George and the very underrated Patrick Patterson.
Yes.
And then basically, that's the they now have, when you factor in that Alex Abrines is older and going to continue to get more playing time, and you know they now are going to have a full season of Jeremy Grant, a full season of Doug McDermott. They now have the shooting that they so desperately lacked last year, and that's key when your best player is Russell Westbrook, because he loves to drive and pass, and guys just need to hit their shots. So I think they had the best season, best off season, and then the other one that had a really great off season. I think it's hard to fault the Houston Rockets. It's an interesting fit to bring Chris Paul in and to potentially bring Carmelo Anthony in, but there's no question they upgraded their talent. And I've always said, you know, a great coach and great players, and especially high IQ players like James Harden and Chris Paul, it's really all about just giving them talent and letting them figure it out. And then D'Antoni, Chris Paul, James Harden, that's a lot of basketball IQ there, especially offensive IQ. And they're going to figure something out. They're going to make this work. I really do believe that they will become an even better team than the team that finished third in the West last year.
Yeah, look, I mean, I got to be honest, I'm skeptical about it. I mean, two ball-dominant guys, and you just had like a souped-up Steve Nash, you know, running D'Antoni's offense and James Harden, and now you want to take the ball out of his hands. So that's a little questionable to me, but I agree. I mean, Daryl Morey, he's all about getting talent and making it work. So I'm fascinated to see it either way. Now, you had a piece about top free agents who are still left. Who are some of those guys that haven't been picked up yet?
That was about a week ago, so most of the guys on the list have been picked up.
Okay.
But I know, you know, there's still some guys. Tyler Ennis was one who was on my list. The backup point guard for the Lakers at the end of last season, kind of finally, Syracuse fans might remember him. You know, he showed some stuff for Syracuse. Left after his freshman year, kind of questionably, when he probably could have used another year. But here's a guy who's still very young, plays point guard, which is, you know, traditionally a position that you see guys developing slower at. And I think he's still got some talent there. And then another one, Alex Len is still available from the Phoenix Suns. They don't seem to have much interest in keeping him. So here's a young center, once again, a young player who you could potentially get some good minutes as a traditional center. And I think even teams that run heavy on small ball still need to have at least an option to play a traditional center. And we've seen teams get burned because they can't stop a guy like Tristan Thompson on the boards, or they can't match up with the Warriors' size, and they can't punish the Warriors down low when they don't have that option, when they have to play small ball all the time. So I think Alex Len is a guy who could be a nice addition to someone.
Addy Joseph joining us today, deputy editor of the For the Win and writes for USA Today Sports. Now, Addy, in your opinion, which team has fared better after their star player left, the Jazz or the Clippers? Who do you think will have the higher seed in the West?
I really, you know, it's funny because, I mean, they're obviously in very different positions because the Clippers got a decent package for Chris Paul, which is stunning to me because Chris could have just left in free agency, but he wanted to go to a team that still had his bird rights, which would allow him to sign the bigger contract. So he opted into his deal and then forced a trade. The result was that the Clippers got Patrick Beverley, who's one of the best, if not the best, defensive point guard in the league. They added Milos Teodosic from Croatia this offseason, who is basically arguably has been the best player not in the NBA for 5 years. He's 30 now. I don't know if he's going to be able to adjust to the NBA quickness quite immediately, but at the very worst, he's clearly a better player than, say, Pablo Prigioni or Sergio Rodriguez. And then you have, you know, just guys like Sam Decker, a young player who the Clippers have historically not done too well with young players, and they added Danilo Gallinari. So, I mean, when you actually look at it, the Clippers are pretty much just as good as they have been. They're just that same team that you don't think can really make it to the Western Conference Finals. And it's an unfortunate position to be in, but now I think they have more upside. I think they have more assets because they're less locked in, and with Blake Griffin under contract, DeAndre Jordan under contract, they don't have to worry about it all falling apart every year like they seem to.
And then how about the Jazz? I feel like their offseason moves have still been pretty good, acquiring Ricky Rubio, and I like the Jonas Derepko signing.
Yeah, I mean, I think they made one of the best moves in the draft. They didn't give up very much, and they got Donovan Mitchell in trading up for him. And I think that Derepko, like you said, he was on my list of guys who at the time were unsigned and could be good values. So my question is, who scores for them? And it's putting a lot on Rodney Hood's shoulders to ask him, after he kind of regressed in the second half of last season. They're now saying, you know, you fell out of favor, you fell out of the starting lineup and out of the rotation to some degree. And now we need you to be our scorer because we don't have anyone else to score. And without Hayward, without George Hill, their offense could be really bad sometimes. And Ricky Rubio is a great passer, but you need guys to finish those passes. And it'll be very interesting to see what Rodney Hood and Derek Favors can do. And they're going to be the sort of bellwethers to tell us how good the Jazz can be.
So sticking in the West here, let's go up to the Timberwolves in Minnesota. I'm always going to keep an eye on them. Kevin Garnett, my favorite player of all time, so I'll always have a heart for the Timberwolves. But when they did the Jimmy Butler trade, I obviously thought they got really good, but I didn't instantly think that they were going to make the playoffs because that was going to be an automatic 13-win jump if they were going to do that. Their following moves, I thought, got them enough to get into the playoffs, maybe even 4 or 5 seed. Where do you see the Wolves in the West next season?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this. I think they were going to be a playoff team either way.
Okay.
I think the biggest thing for them is just these young guys getting better. And, you know, Andrew Wiggins is about to sign more than likely. I mean, it's already been reported that they're negotiating. I'm guessing that they're going to give Andrew Wiggins a max deal and hope that he does what many players have in the past, which is take that max deal and make the improvements necessary. And Karl Anthony Towns, you can't really say enough about him. I think we kind of forgot how good he and Anthony Davis were because their teams weren't. But last season, he and Anthony Davis were just insane and put up numbers that we haven't really seen much of since Shaq's prime. So those two guys, Anthony Davis for the Pelicans, obviously, I think both of them are moving toward being ascendant super duper star big men, and Towns alone is enough reason for me to believe that they were going to make the playoffs. But adding Butler, who is one of the most efficient, I don't think enough people realize how efficient this guy is. He doesn't make mistakes. He's a very low mistake superstar, and that's a rare thing. And so he's going to give plenty of room for Karl Anthony Towns to do his thing while still being that solidifying factor, that guy who helps teach Wiggins how to defend. I really like what they've done, but I think that they were going to improve even without Jimmy Butler.
So LeBron wasn't even a free agent this offseason, but it seems like everything still kind of revolves around him, and for good reason. Now, there's been a lot of Lakers buzz with LeBron showing up at Summer League and all the things you're hearing out of his camp. Now, I can't get over the fact that I don't understand why he wants to leave the East. To me, if he heads West, his trip to the finals is way harder. But I can understand him wanting to leave Cleveland in that whole Dan Gilbert situation. What are your thoughts on LeBron? Like, do you actually see him heading West?
I don't think LeBron cares much about getting to the finals. I don't think LeBron cares about anything other than what's best for LeBron and how to win a championship. From a team success standpoint, he wants to win a championship. And if he doesn't feel like the Cavs have the right front office to make the right moves to keep improving the team, he doesn't feel like the Cavs can win a championship. And if I'm being honest, I think the Cavs regressed this offseason, even with some very small moves like Jeff Green that they made. If they're regressing at all, and they're regressing further because the West, the best teams in the West all got way better. So even now, even if the Warriors deal with some major injury to Draymond Green or Stephen Curry and they don't make the finals, you suddenly have a West with three or four better teams than Cleveland in terms of talent. And that's a lot for LeBron to have to deal with, because he knows that when it gets to the finals, no matter which of those teams he's facing, he's going to have to put his team on his back. So for him, he wants a franchise that's going to, I don't want to say acquiesce to everything he says, because I don't even think that's what he wants. I think he wants to feel like it's a partnership, like he's in a situation where he can gain something. And I don't think that Dan Gilbert has done a good job of making LeBron feel like he has something to gain by staying in Cleveland.
Okay, yeah, I would totally agree with that. How about LeBron's buddies, Carmelo and Wade? Do you see a Carmelo Anthony trade? I know it seemed close lately the other day with the Knicks, or do you both see maybe both buyout options?
Yeah, I'm thinking the Knicks won't buy out Wade. I don't think either of them will be bought out.
Okay.
Because their owners are cheap. Wade maybe gets bought out toward the trade deadline. If they can't move him in a trade at the deadline, then after that they waive him, just like Deron Williams was.
Mm-hmm.
And just like Deron Williams, I think he'd probably sign with Cleveland. But I don't imagine that the Knicks are going to waive Carmelo with multiple years left on his max deal. And I think that there probably is going to be a trade. I wouldn't give up much for him, but I see why the Rockets want him, why James Harden and Chris Paul, who are both close friends of Carmelo, want to play with him, and that seems like the most likely scenario, because the Cavs really can't give up anyone but Kevin Love in an effort to get him, and that's not, I don't think that benefits them to give up Kevin Love for Carmelo Anthony.
Okay. I believe it was announced yesterday or maybe early today that the NBA was getting rid of the home-wide jerseys, and they're going to do four types of different jerseys. The home team gets to choose, and then the road team has to choose a different color. Do you like this, or is this the NBA trying to do a little too much?
I do like it, because I think it's going to give us cool. I mean, first of all, I'll fully admit that I think, I generally trust what Nike does. I generally trust what the NBA does when it comes to style and fashion and looking cool. So with those two companies collaborating, I think there's no question the Kings have already unleashed, and the Warriors, I believe, have already announced at least part of their kits. Four options is a good thing. It's going to give fans a lot of flexibility on what they want to wear. And this is a good way to mix it up so that fans don't have to see the team wearing the same color. You know, if you're a Warriors fan and you're constantly seeing the same jerseys, this is a great way to see your road jerseys, because they tend to mix it up even more on the road. So, you know, I think that that's a good thing, and it's mostly a semantics point, because I'm sure that home teams being allowed to choose, they'll probably have a favorite look, and they'll probably go with that favorite look quite often.
Okay. Adi Joseph, USA Today, join us. Adi, we'll get you out of here on this. You recently checked out the Big Three League that Ice Cube started, the 3-on-3 basketball with former NBA players. Now, it's mostly been on tape delay, if not all on tape delay, so that's mostly how I've been checking it out. And, you know, I haven't gravitated as much as I would hope to, but you got to see it in person, so what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I saw their opening weekend in Barclays Center, and I saw last weekend, and what turned out to be a bit of a disaster in Philadelphia when Allen Iverson didn't play. And I think that last weekend was a perfect example. Fans were enjoying it, were engaged, were really excited about it all day. For the first, the way the schedule works, it's about a four plus, a slightly more than 4 hour event. You go, you watch four games. They usually save the biggest game for last. And fans were really enjoying it. You know, there's some good players still in this league. Rashard Lewis looks like he could easily step into an NBA roster for next season. And Al Harrington still has a lot of his skills. There's a few other guys who are still very good. And on top of that, you know, they play really physical basketball. The three-on-three that we were worried wouldn't be entertaining in a half-court setting can be when they're playing it well. But what we've seen, too, is that the biggest names in this league kind of are the most unreliable. And so Allen Iverson gave 25-minute warning to fans that he wasn't going to play. So everyone had already bought tickets. And this is Philadelphia. People bought tickets specifically to see him play. And many of them didn't even know he wasn't going to play until the game had already started. Another, you know, another case was Chauncey Billups, who's, I believe, only been at one of the events, and he's one of the biggest names. So it's a league where they want it to be focused on the quality of play and the fact that these guys still have it in a half-court setting, that these 38 to 49-year-olds can still kind of hang, you know, in a half-court setting. And they can, but I feel like if you're going there just for the nostalgia of seeing one guy, and that guy isn't Rashard Lewis or Al Harrington, you might end up a little disappointed.
Okay. Adi Joseph, USA Today Sports, and For the Win. Thanks very much for joining me, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Miss us?
Come here, brother. Give me a hug. Bring it in for the real thing.
We're on call for you. Catch the podcast at HailVarsity.com, the ESPN Lincoln app, or download them on iTunes.
Saddle up, partner.
Back to Hail Varsity Radio.
Welcome back into Hail Varsity Radio. I'm now joined by Mike Babcock at HailVarsity.com. Mike, how are we doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great, just great.
Obviously, the big news out of the weekend was the Chris Jones injury, and I think a lot of the coaches or even fans would prefer that Chris Jones were to redshirt and come back for a full season after that, but I'm not sure a guy like Chris Jones works that way. You know, he might already be close to his degree, plus a guy that close to the NFL, you know, I don't know if he wants to spend a whole another extra year in college if he doesn't have to, so I could see him coming back early. What are your thoughts on what he should do or what maybe he's thinking?
You know, and I'm not a real active social media person, but it seems as if he has indicated that, you know, he plans to come back quicker than people think, and maybe he wants to put himself in a position where there's still an opportunity for him to play at the end of the season. But yeah, I think it's a legitimate conversation topic because of the injury, because of the nature of really what's happened in terms of evaluation of Chris Jones and talk about the NFL potential and so forth. Part of it is, I guess, if you have that as in your future, you don't want to, when you go through a traumatic injury, if you come back from it, you don't want to put it in jeopardy again if you have that opportunity in the NFL. But, you know, people need to advise him that are smarter about that aspect of it than I am. But certainly has to consider a future, his future in that whatever decision he makes.
So looking forward, though, replacing him for at least 3 months, maybe longer, you know, obviously 4 to 6 months range is what they gave us. So in my estimation, I would just easily move Kalu back to corner and then Kyren Williams back to safety. How about you? What would be your opinion?
You know, TJ, that's the way I would do it. And I know that there was there's been some discussion about whether Joshua Kalu is just much more comfortable as a safety, and that his skill set fits safety better, which then puts, ideally that's what you like to have happen, I think, because then you got experienced guys moving back into positions. Kyren Williams obviously is an experienced guy and has shown an ability to make big plays. I think there's maybe, hasn't always been in the best position or whatever, but he's made big plays. But the question, I guess, is part of the move was to get Joshua Kalu at safety because he could provide for them at that position. And part of it was that they felt like his skill set was better suited to safety than corner.
Mike Babcock, HaleVarsity.com, joining me today. Now, Mike, on HaleVarsity.com, you've been doing a great job of the all-time teams, top 10 recruits from each state. Last time we talked to you, I believe we talked about New Jersey and Louisiana. You've got a couple more states out now we can talk about. You did your all-time Dakota team, so you could buy in North Dakota and South Dakota. But I'm curious, though, who ended up winning that battle? Was it South or North Dakota?
Well, you know, I think that Nebraska's recruited more football players from South Dakota than North Dakota. So if you're evaluating okay. that way, I think the balance goes obviously to South Dakota in numbers. And then you've got three guys at the top of that list that are kind of no-brainers. I've done these things before, but, I went back through all the stuff, and it's no-brainer to have, I think, Larry Jacobson first and John Dutton second and Randy Schleusner third, just because those guys were all consensus All-Americans. A significant, Larry Jacobson was on that 70 and 71 national championship team's first Outland Trophy winner. I think the highest-ranked North Dakota guy I had was Bill Jansen, and he was a really good player. He was hurt in 1970, came back in 71 as it was a starter, and he was a co-captain his senior year. But, in terms of numbers of people to consider there, North Dakota, Nebraska just has not recruited that many guys from North Dakota. I think on my list, I think I had, in addition to Jansen, I obviously Brent Qualley was on there, and I had Darren Erstad mm-hmm. at number 10. So, South Dakota kind of wins it, but it would be a little bit like playing 11 on 9 or 11 on 8 or something like that, just in terms of numbers of guys that have been recruited. There was actually a South Dakota guy, I want to say his name was Greg Ching, things just didn't work out for him. But he came from South Dakota, and I want to say he played 9-man football, which I had never heard of before.
Yeah, I've never heard that either.
Yeah, that's yeah. interesting. Now, I might be wrong, my memory. maybe isn't what it used to be, but it seems as if he were a lineman and that he had played 9-man football, which, whatever that is, I've never seen that. But I guess he got 8 and 6, so maybe somewhere they had 9.
Yeah, I guess so. And then the most recent guy in these all-Dakota teams, number 4, Nathan Gary, came in there from South Dakota.
Yeah.
So let's...
Yeah, I thought Nathan had a mm-hmm. nice career. He's a 3-year starter. He came in as a... there was a little bit of concern at the end of his career, obviously, because he wasn't able to play in the bowl game for things that he could have controlled himself. But, I think he had a nice career. He came in and played some linebacker and even started once or twice at linebacker as a true freshman. I definitely think that he belonged in the conversation there, and I had him at number 4.
So let's now switch over to the all-time Ohio team, and I guess I could have done more digging on this, but I didn't realize that maybe one of my favorite Huskers of all time, DeJuan Gross, is from Ohio, and he comes in at number 30.
Yeah, DeJuan, he was an outstanding kick returner. Yeah. That's the thing. He earned All-American recognition for that. And, he's one of those guys, he was very talented, and he was a great guy to deal with. I guess that shouldn't influence my decision on how I rank people. But yeah, he was also he received recognition as an All Big 12 corner, and he had 4 punt return touchdowns one season. I think he had 7 or 8 for his career. Remarkable punt returner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then at number 1 you had Bob Brown, number 2 Willie Harper, and then right after DeJuan at number 4 you had Frank Solich, and obviously Frank back in Ohio, coaching Ohio University. Now you did some really cool digging here also with this Ohio piece, and you noticed that Bo obviously is an Ohio guy, and he kind of hit that hard state more than the 3 previous head coaches, correct?
Yeah, definitely. That was one of the things that I wanted to sort of emphasize. I tried to have a connection somehow, with the current program where Mike Riley was recruiting guys that work from states, that there are some recruits this year. And so I picked Ohio, even though the majority of Ohio guys came in really before Osborne. And that was, I think, I'd have to go back and look now, but the number that Bo recruited was more, out of Ohio, was more than the three coaches that preceded him combined. So you got to go back to Devaney and Bill Jennings, where you find some of the guys on my list, Ron McDowell, Bill Thornton. Now, obviously, Bob Brown was already here when Devaney got here, and there's a guy that his jersey, his number is only one of two that are retired in Nebraska. He's in both the Pro Football and the College Football Hall of Fame, unanimous All-America. I mean, he just had a remarkable career, and for about 10 years, my uncle was the equipment manager in Nebraska, and prior to that, he helped with the grounds crew, and so he knew a little bit about some of those guys from that era, and he always told me that the remarkable thing. Now, Bob Brown was he earned this recognition as a lineman. You know, obviously that's what he played in the NFL, offensive line, but he also played some linebacker at Nebraska, and he was so powerful, and you figure a guy that was about 260 pounds playing linebacker in the early 60s had to have been a monster. And I guess he would just, it was difficult for blockers to get to him because he was so strong and powerful. And so I thought he was a clear-cut number one, but as I said in the lead-in to it, I thought Willie Harper is one of the overlooked guys, I think, because he played on teams with Johnny Rogers and Rich Glover, two guys that got national attention in the terms of Heisman Trophy, Allen Trophy, Lombardi Award, or whatever. But Willie Harper was a three-year starter. He was two-time consensus All-American. He was just a remarkable player, and were it not for a guy like Bob Brown being on the list, Willie Harper would have been right at the top. And you know, I think Frank Solich, even though he didn't earn All-America recognition or anything like that, he's the first Husker to rush for 200 or more yards. Obviously, I consider the fact that he was Husker's head coach. He was a co-captain. He was an outstanding kick returner. I mean, he did everything. And you figure that the guy that didn't weigh 160 pounds at fullback, you kind of shake your head about that. But the offense was so different then that the fullback could be, he'd be running behind an unbalanced line and a halfback like Kent McLuhan. I mean, the halfbacks were bigger than he was. And a lot of times that's how they ran the offense, is that the fullback ran behind that line and behind one of those halfbacks that were leading the way.
Yeah, and Coach Riley, he's gotten two players out of Ohio already, Matt Sichterman and Tony Butler. Got about less than 30 seconds, Mike. What state is coming up next?
Well, I was thinking about Iowa. I know how much people in Nebraska enjoy Iowa, anything related to Iowa, but some good players came out of there from Nebraska, and John Reardon's here now. You know, his dad played at Nebraska, so I thought Iowa might be the next one. I was thinking about doing one on Four Corners, you know, those Four Corners states. I don't know if I'd have enough for any one state, but that's kind of a different way to look at things. Nebraska's gotten some guys out of each of those, I think. I need to go back and take a look for sure, but I'm trying to find something a little more than just, cut and dried stuff. But I think probably Iowa is the next one I'm looking at.
All right, well, sounds good. Mike Babcock, HaleVarsity.com. Thanks so much for joining me, Mike. Appreciate it.
Hey, great talking to you, TJ.
All-State, two-year starter, and rush in for the Big Red, an NFL vet.
Is Dudeness or Duder or, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
It's Blackshirt Jay Moore with Hail Varsity Radio.
Well, sadly, no, there is no Jay Moore today, but the British Open is this weekend, and I know Jay Moore is excited about that. So in his honor, we're playing his intro, and it is time for the Wilderness Ridge Golf segment. Make sure you get yourself a membership down at Wilderness Ridge. There's no initiation fee. There's unlimited golf on all 27 holes. You're going to want to be a part of this. You can get meet Director of Golf Chris Thompson, and, of course, the guy who's with us here every week, Director of Instruction Mike Schuhart. Mike, how we doing, man?
I'm doing great, man. You're holding down the fort all by yourself.
I am.
You're doing awesome.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. The phone number for Wilderness Ridge, 402-434-5106. And, of course, wildernessridgegolf.com is the website to get more info. Yeah, Schmidt, they're probably driving on their way back. They were checking out the Minnesota Twins, New York Yankees
nice.
Series as a family. You know, Junior, big bandwagon guy, so he's got to be on those Yankees and Judge, of course. So.
Anytime.
But obviously, the British Open this week, huge deal. And I was racking my brain trying to remember last year, but last year was a crazy finish. Do you remember that with Henrik Stenson and Phil Mickelson?
Yeah.
So Stenson was what? What about my notes here? He shot a 63 on the final day, 10 birdies. Phil, and so he was 20 under, and Phil was 17 under. And it was also the largest gap between a second-place guy and a third-place guy. J.B. Holmes was 11 back of Phil in second place. I mean, that was a crazy one last year.
It was, man. That's just wrong, kind of bad timing on Phil's part. I mean, he'd win 9 times out of 10, you know? He just happened to run into a guy that got pretty hot at the right time.
Man, no kidding. I mean, 17 under, the guy makes 10 birdies that day on Sunday. That's crazy, especially in the British Open. So the news, though, coming out of this British Open, Phil Mickelson says he won't be using any drivers in the Open.
Yeah.
How unusual is that?
Not really for this venue.
Okay.
Because if you look in years past this venue, it's a pretty narrow golf course. It's not super long golf course. It's got, I'm going to say, at least 6 to possibly 10 basically blind shots. I mean, you're just hitting it right over the gorse.
Okay.
You have no idea where you're hitting it. You're just hitting it over a bush out there in the gorse, and you're going up into the clouds, and it's like it's a really unique golf course. Years past, if you look at guys that have won there, they're not the longest hitters. You know, they're pretty accurate, good ball strikers, not super long. Again, the golf course isn't super long. Incredible short games because you got to have a lot of creativity around there. So, like Mark O'Meara, you know, he won a few years back. One on that golf course, so I wouldn't anticipate you seeing one of the bombers out there playing really well, especially Phil making comments like that. You know, he's not even going to hit a driver all week.
Yeah,
you know, and
apparently he didn't use a driver back in the 2008 U.S. Open at Torrey Pines.
Yeah.
It was the last time they said he did that. So, and then this course is the Birkdale course, and you alluded to the course. Now, I'm a novice when it comes to golf. The British Open is a links course, correct?
Correct.
Can you tell me what a links course, the definition of that is?
So, not a lot of trees, basically.
Okay.
A lot of berms and deep bunkers and call it gorse. It's a different kind of grass, you know. They don't really have rough like we're used to rough. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you hit it out of the fairway, you're in the gorse, man. And it's like up to your ankles half the time. Again, not a lot of trees out there, a lot of mounds and bumps and humps, and especially like this golf course, like I said. I mean, there's a lot of that out there that you're hitting over and around, and so you don't really know. You know, a lot of shots are blind. You don't know where you're going. So it's basically you have to pick a yardage, you have to pick a spot, you have to have a club that goes there, and you need to kind of hit it out there and pretty much know where you're hitting it and how far you're hitting it.
So would you say maybe the British Open is the second toughest for pro golfers? Because my favorite thing about the U.S. Open is it's usually the toughest, and you see guys who win with like a +1 or +2. However, that wasn't this case this past U.S. Open.
Yeah.
So I was a little disappointed. But, I mean, like, the weather plays such a huge part in the British Open, doesn't it?
Exactly. You know, I look at it kind of, it's two different games. The British Open is typically more a ground game. You know, U.S. Open, PGA, it's more of an air game. Because, again, long, rough, you know, typical U.S. PGA, U.S. Open, small greens, hard greens, fast greens, a lot of rough. You got to hit the ball up in the air to try to get it on the greens. Over there, it's hard, fast, windy, raining, and weird conditions. So it's like you got to keep your ball on the ground a little bit more. So you play a lot more shots that are low to the ground, shots along the ground. Again, that's why Phil, you know, years back when Tiger went over there, he hit his 2-iron. All he did was hit his 2-iron stinger all day long. So he was just hitting low 2-irons that were going about 290. Well, they were only really going about 200, but they were rolling 90 yards.
Wow.
So fairways are usually firm and fast over there.
Okay.
But if you get off, man, it is treacherous. I mean, they have just places that you can't be. You can't hardly escape from. Weather is typically the biggest factor over there. If they get some benign conditions, guys will shoot pretty good. If they get some typical conditions, I think I was watching a little bit of it this morning, and it was blowing 25 and raining, and so pretty typical.
Man. So you've played in 7 major opens, correct?
Uh-huh.
But never in the British Open.
Have
you ever played at all ever in like the Europe area?
I have. I played actually 1992, I think it was. I was lucky enough to qualify for what was called the United States Cup team, which is the club pro version of the Ryder Cup.
Hmm.
So they take the top club pros in the United States, and we play the top club pros from Europe. And we played at the K Club over in Ireland, where they played the Ryder Cup a few years ago. So that was a really awesome experience. That was probably my number one golfing experience I've ever had.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Representing your country, playing in a Ryder Cup format, you know, overseas.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty cool. It was really cool, actually.
Oh, man. That's really neat.
So it was pretty fun.
For the Open, is it called the jug, the Claire jug? Is that what it's
correct.
The trophy? Yeah. Okay. Very cool. So there's also talk, and we get into this next segment too, but there's talk about moving the PGA Championship from August to May in 2019. And I kind of really like this because, to me, that's the one major that kind of gets forgotten. And I don't know if it gets overshadowed because of baseball or football, but I guess I've always kind of thought of that as like my least favorite major. So I kind of like this. What are your thoughts on that?
I kind of like that too, actually, because it starts to get into that end of the year, you know. The Masters, everybody, because it's the start of golf season, everybody's excited about the Masters. And then the U.S. Open, obviously, it's the United States Open. And then you have the British Open, and then the PGA kind of falls in the latter part of the year. And again, you start to fight football.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people are getting excited about football and into baseball and playoffs and things like that. So, yeah, I like it. I think they're looking at moving that to try to see if it can maintain. I mean, it's still a very popular event, but just to increase the excitement of it.
Yeah, and I think they were saying that they would maybe then have to move the Players' Championship up to March, I believe.
I think so.
So that's a pretty big non-major, though, right? Is that correct?
That's considered the fifth major.
That's what I thought. Okay.
So a lot of the guys out there consider that the fifth major out there. You know, that's it just doesn't get kind of the accolades the other ones do. You know, hadn't been around as long as the other ones. But and all the players out there, that is the fifth major on the tour.
Okay. Well, sounds very good. Coming up in the next break, we'll get to some of the odds, who are the favorites to win the British Open, who Shuey likes to win.
All
Maybe
right.
I'll even give a prediction, so we'll see. I wouldn't take it to the bank.
We'll see how good you are.
But through the Wilderness Ridge Golf Segment with Mike Shuhart, again, 402-434-5106 or wildernessridgegolf.com to get yourself a membership today. Coming up the break, more Mike Shuhart, Wilderness Ridge Golf Segment.
And now, back to Hail Varsity Radio.
Welcome back to Hail Varsity Radio. It's the Wilderness Ridge Golf Segment with Mike Shuhart from Wilderness Ridge Golf. Make sure you go get yourself a membership today. Great deals out there as always. Plus, get some great food, some great drinks on that patio.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a good time there. So we're talking about British Open, kind of getting to the odds here. Before we get into some of the guys who are the odds, 3 guys moved ahead of Dustin Johnson, the world's number one ranked golfer in these odds. What type of players, whose games would translate well to the British Open in this links style?
I really like a Ricky Fowler.
Okay.
You know, very consistent ball striker. Hits a little more of a low ball flight. Very conducive to hopefully what the conditions are in the golf course itself.
Okay.
Tommy Fleetwood, another guy I like a lot. He's had a great year. I mean, he played awesome in the U.S. Open, and he's had a great year over there. He might be number one on the the European Order of Merit over there, I think, I saw. So he's playing really, really solid golf right now. So that's a local guy. That's a U.S. guy and a European guy right there.
So, yeah, Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, and John Rahm have moved past Dustin Johnson, their world number one golfer, and climbed to the top of the odds to win the Open Championship. You named the guy that I was going to pick. My choice would be Ricky Fowler. I want that guy to finally break through and get that first major. So that's who I'm definitely rooting for.
I think a lot of people want that, too. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just a class act, you know, and he's played good. He's put himself in position to be able to get there. So it's like you just kind of hope he finishes one off. But Louis Oosthuizen is another one I like a lot. You know, just a really solid ball striker, really good ball striker, very good command. And basically kind of hits it kind of like what you need on that golf course. Mm-hmm. And I think he's played there in the past, and he's played well there in the past. So,
is that your choice? Putting you on the spot.
And then, I know. And I like Justin Rose a lot, too. Justin Rose, they were talking about him the other day.
He's 15-1, it looks like.
Yeah, because when he was 14 or something, he played there for the first time, and he holed it out of the rough on the last hole for Eagle to finish, like, fourth as a 14-year-old. Hmm. So now it's come way back full circle, and he's playing there again. So I like him a lot. That's actually who I like. I like him and Ricky a lot.
And Rory's 20-1 odds, and so 15-1 was Justin Rose and Hideki Matsuyama. So there you go. And another name golfer I like, DeChambeau. Jay Moore got me into that guy. That's an interesting guy.
He had a nice week last week.
Yeah, that's right. And then here in Nebraska, in Omaha, we have the Pinnacle Bank Championship, correct, Shui?
Yeah, that starts tomorrow up at Elkhorn.
Okay.
So if you want to watch some good golf, man, these guys can flat play. We just had a closed qualifier. So they have a closed qualifier for guys that want to try to get into the event. And we had one at Wilderness actually on Monday. And guy broke the course record out there.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And it took you – you had to shoot 65 to qualify. And there were six spots available. So there's 63, 64, and 465. So – boys can flat play.
Wow. So if you're not on the British Open, you're maybe likely at this or maybe another PGA.
You'd be one of them. There's another off, you know, they have another PGA event that's going on at the same time for the guys that don't go over and play in the British Open. But, there's going to be some fantastic players. Indian Creek up in Elkhorn. I mean, if you want to watch some great golf, I would highly recommend going up there and watching this week. There's some fantastic players up there.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Mike Schuhart with me, Wilderness Ridge Golf Segment. Thanks so much for joining me, man.
Man, always, man.
Glad to have somebody in here with me today.
I know it. You were lonely.
That's right. All right. That was the Wilderness Ridge Golf Segment. Hour two coming up. O.J. Simpson's parole is on Thursday. We're going to have that live for you. But before that, we're going to hear from O.J.'s former agent, Mike Gilbert. You're going to miss that.
Welcome to Hail Varsity Radio, the voice of Husker Nation. Insight, opinion, expertise, with the biggest and best names talking Nebraska across the state. Join the show on Twitter at Hail Varsity and at Schmitz_radio. Call in at 402-466-ESPN or 1-800-825-5865. Here's Chris Schmitz and TJ Henning.
Welcome back into Hour 2 of Hail Varsity Radio. TJ Henning here, filling in for Chris Schmidt. My thanks to Adi Joseph of USA Today Sports and Mike Babcock of HailVarsity.com. And, of course, Mike Schuhart of Wilderness Ridge Golf for joining me in that first hour. Now, in the second hour, we're going to have the Jock Doc, hear about Chris Jones' meniscus injury. And then coming up next, we're going to have this guy on Friday, because the O.J. Simpson parole, we're going to bring that to you live tomorrow, Thursday. OJ's former agent, Mike Gilbert, joined us last year, and it was just one of the best interviews you will ever hear. It's part of OJ's inner circle, was his former agent. You can hear about the glove, you can hear about the Bronco, all that great stuff. So here we go. Mike Gilbert joins us on Hail Varsity Radio right now.
Mike Gilbert, our guest, Hail Varsity Radio, part of OJ Simpson's inner circle, former agent and author, How I Helped OJ Get Away with Murder, the shocking inside story of violence, loyalty, regret, and remorse. Mike, we're not too many years removed, but it seems kind of like yesterday to me. Today's date, 22 years ago, the day after Rockingham. Take us through your time there and what you remember.
Sure, Chris. Oddly enough, I was in probably my most favorite place on Earth, a place I've always gone over the years to relax and kind of put things into perspective. I was rock climbing in Yosemite National Park with my middle son, David, when we went to bed last night, 22 years ago last night, and woke up on the 13th, hiked to the top of Yosemite Falls, and decided I was going to do this rock climb called Lost Arrow Spire. Went down to call my wife, and as soon as I started leaving a message, she picked up the phone and said, "You need to get to Rockingham. Nicole's been murdered, and OJ's in handcuffs." And it was when they were live showing OJ when he had just gotten back from Chicago. And needless to say, from that day forward, nothing has ever been the same.
Take me through your meeting with O.J. Simpson and your involvement with him, as close as you were to him. One of the lasting points from episode one of O.J. Made in America was the quote, "I'm not black, I'm O.J." The race dynamic and how about O.J.'s peers in the African American community and O.J. in white society in Brentwood and L.A., that whole dynamic. How was it for O.J., and how was it for you being a part of this inner circle?
Well, I'll tell you, the odd thing was, I think a lot of people have taken that out of context, and they'll say O.J. wanted to be white. He was ashamed of being black and so forth, and that was actually not the case. When O.J. and I had talked about it, which we had ad nauseum, he told me numerous times that until athletes and just any person of color, until you're accepted just as being a great athlete or a great person, you still have a long road to hoe. And I agree with that. How do you, identify as I'm black, I'm white, whatever it is. OJ always wanted to just be known as a great athlete. Not that he didn't want to be black. It's just that he wanted to be known as a football player, because that's what he was. He didn't want to be used by various political, areas or people that were trying to get him involved. And he said, that was okay for them if that's what they wanted to do. But why should he be pressured into doing something that he wasn't comfortable with?
Take me through the trial will be very prominent here in the upcoming episodes of 30 for 30, but Mike, your contact with OJ, specifically when it comes to that scene that I remember from the FX series that I'm sure will be addressed on the upcoming 30 for 30, when the OJ's mansion's redecorated. There's black pictures put up. There's white pictures taken down. And then also OJ in the gloves. You're very
right.
Locked in with both parts of those instances.
Well, yeah, let me touch on the gloves real quick. A lot of people, including my publisher, editor, everyone, they always go back to my statement to OJ about the gloves, and my whole, that was taken out of context. What my meaning was when I was talking to OJ, I said, "Look, OJ, the gloves are going to go on you. Either the prosecution's going to put them on you or we're going to, but either way, you're wearing the gloves." And he said, "Mike, I'm not going to wear them. They have Nicole's blood on them, and I'm not going to put the gloves on." And I thought maybe he was worried about, the gloves fitting or what have you. And I said, "OJ, if you're worried about the gloves fitting, just don't take your arthritis medicine." And he said, "Mike, my hands would hurt like hell." And I said, "Yeah, why?" Meaning, of course, his hands would then swell up over the next few days. So that's what OJ did. He just didn't take his arthritis medicine. However, my real meaning was I was more concerned, with OJ when he went to put the gloves on. We already had an expert that said, yes, these are the exact gloves you would wear. And everybody in Husker territory, you get some pretty cold winters. Mm-hmm. So, it's preference. Do you like your gloves snug, where they're really nice and tight? Or do you like them where you can pull them off really easy, where they're a little bit big? So I thought the gloves would fit. I could care less if they did or didn't. I was worried of how he acted when he went to put them on. Would he act like, you know,